Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, emotion worker, and a lot more that you probably don't know about. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we're all grappling with these days and this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday to you, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Brad. Nice to see you. Alrighty. Where are we off to today? Well, today I have a studio full of friendly faces, and we're going to be talking about communication in different forms. Communicating community experiences, communicating likes and dislikes, communicating through conflict, communicating to build closer relationships and understanding. So a lot of great information, I imagine, about how we can all incorporate different communication skills to be more successful. And as we've talked about in many shows, you know, communication itself, just being able to allow words to fall out of our head, does not mean that we are actually successfully communicating with another person. That actual communication, the ability to exchange ideas and to find consensus and to feel connected and close to others, requires a much different skill set. So we're going to tap into a bit of that today. But I want to start off introducing a longtime family friend and a regular contributor to the program over the last many years, Kyle Berlin. Hello, Kyle.
Hi, Elizabeth.
All right. So Kyle grew up with our family. And if you've listened to the show for any amount of time, you've heard me sing his praises, graduate of Rio Grande High School, graduate of Princeton, valedictorian of Princeton, and then a man of the world. I think I'll put it nicely that way. Can I use vagabond again? Because we enjoyed it so much the last time.
I embrace vagabond.
Thank you. A vagabond documentary playwright is part of the many things you've done. You've done fellowships. You've traveled and lived in different parts of the world, studying melancholy. And we've talked about that, kind of the essence of melancholy and how it's described in different communities. But you've landed on the last, I don't know, 8 years maybe, through your theater company, Rhizome, that you co-founded with Ashlyn Hatch, who's another one of our local graduates of Rio Grande High School and then off doing great things in the world. You founded this company, this theater company, and I'm going to let you describe it more, but basically do interviews within the community on a topic with citizens, and you gather all of these different conversations and dialogues, and then you put together staged readings using the actual dialogue from the people that you've interviewed with a through line theme. And so you've come back to the Central Coast and been working on for quite a while a new project that's going to be offered two times in the next month, one on April 6th and one on April 13th. And so I wanted to invite you in for a few minutes at the top of the show today to talk about it, one, because one of the readings is this Sunday in San Luis Obispo, and I don't want people to miss out, but talk a little bit about the Napomo plot.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Yes. So as you said, the medium that me and my theater company that I co-founded, Rhizome Theater Company, that we work in is documentary theater company. Usually when you hear documentary, you think film. Mm-hmm. But what we do is we work with documents, archives, public records, as well as new interviews that we conduct and record with people, as you said. And from that bed of material, we weave together, we collage a textual script that is then performed live, often by actors or ourselves or indeed community members themselves who share the stories and this weave together document that is diving deep on a particular topic or particular community or place. So in this instance, I've dug deep on a local issue about the proposed development at the Dana Reserve in Napomo. I was struck. I just happened to be in town in San Luis Obispo almost exactly a year ago. The Board of Supervisors was having a meeting to determine the future of this plot of land, and I was struck by the outpouring of community comments, mm-hmm. really on both sides of the issue, people mm-hmm. speaking on behalf of about 4,000 mature California oak trees, which would be cut down to make about 1,500 new homes, and people speaking on behalf of the homes, the need for housing, the affordable housing crisis in our county and in the state. And so from that really hot button issue, I pieced together this play, which goes deep on this particular plot of land and asks the question of how far back can we trace this land? How do we get to this moment in time? And what does the future of this plot look like?
What I love, because I got to see an early iteration of this play, was the deep dive you did in the history of the land. You know, it's fascinating to see long before we were having conversations about needing affordable housing, there was an entire life of this place and this property and the people who came here and were here. And how important are those conversations today as we're moving forward, changing the nature of nature? Mm-hmm. And how that will impact generations moving forward. And I really love how well you've connected all of those things together, and that it doesn't feel partisan. It feels just more like you're sharing the stories.
Well, and that's our hope, is that we're just trying to tell as sort of honest and complete a picture of this particular plot of land as much as we can, and understand, as I said, how did we get to this moment in time? And go further back than we're used to thinking. Like, what if we go 100 years back, 200 years back? Mm-hmm. The trees that are on that land now are about 250 years old. That's as old as this country. It's way older than this state. You know, all the things that have happened in the time that those very trees have been alive. Or what if you go back 10,000 years and the only people who were here were the Chumash Native Americans? And the sort of, you know, decades of time that we're looking at now really pale in comparison to the deep history of that particular plot.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of seven generation forward thinking in our decisions as a country, but that's a whole other conversation, isn't it? So you said that, you know, you were coming through town to do this. How is this playwriting style, the documentary playwriting style, how have you also performed it or shared it in different places here originally and in other parts of the country and the world?
Yeah.
So what topics have you taken on?
Our original production was in Arroyo Grande, where I'm from, and we called it Nice Town, Normal People, and interrogating what is a nice town, what is normal people. And that was, we were surprised by how that sort of struck a chord for a lot of people, and we ended up touring that around the country. And every time we did it in a new place, we did in Chicago, in Princeton, New Jersey, in Maine, in New York, people would see it and say, oh my gosh, this reminds me of my town, or then you should come to this place. So we followed those invitations, and so we've done productions now. We've embedded in a super small rural community in Maine. We've worked with neurotrauma survivors and the people who care for them in Pittsburgh. Most recently, we did a show about grandmas, where we interviewed Central Coast grandmas about their kind of reflections on aging and womanhood. These are just some examples, but I've also worked in Argentina and Brazil using this kind of documentary ethnographic theater method to interrogate Amazonian eco-poetics, to work with Senegalese migrants to Buenos Aires. So it's just it's a methodology. I think of it as a kind of methodology and analog technology for creating these live gathering events that are drawn from the real world, real words of real people, and honoring this kind of living oral tradition and culture that we live within. So that's our ethos. And
I love that ethos. And also, it gets people out of their house and off their phones for a couple hours and being a part of a theater experience, which you and I both know that theater itself is a community building experience. To sit in a room with people that you might have no connection with, but to have a similar experience together, it changes that group of people.
Absolutely. And especially, and this is why I like this mode so much, especially when the story on stage is about the very community that is in the room.
Yep.
So with this Dana Reserve Napoma plot play, which is coming up, you know, there are going to be people in those rooms. Basically, it's about their story. It's about the work that they've put into their activism and their hopes on both sides of the issue, and mm-hmm. to sort of see themselves reflected on stage in that way and be able to sit in the same room as other people for a couple hours and kind of relive this reflective moment from a different angle and a different kind of artistic lens is the powerful kind of moment that we hope to instill.
Right. So if people want to come see the Nipomo plot, your first reading is this Sunday, April 6th in San Luis Obispo from 2 to 4 p.m.
Yes. So that and that's sponsored by the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club. Mm-hmm. So I encourage people to just go to their website, Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club. You can look up the Nipomo plot, and it's going to be at the French Hospital Copeland Health Pavilion in San Luis Obispo. It's free, but they do ask people to RSVP, so we encourage you to go to that, to the Sierra Club SLO website.
So it is a free event. And yes, if you think if you just even Google the Santa Lucia chapter, I saw that there was a link right there to reserve. Bring friends. Are you going to do a talk back after?
Yeah, this is vital. This is an in-progress reading. This is a draft script. I mean, we're going to have some really good performers, but it's not a final version play with sets and props and memorized script. This is an in-progress reading, and so we're really looking for community feedback. People who maybe know about the Dana Reserve, have been involved with this issue, or people who know nothing about it but want to know more, or you know, have thoughts about land use decision making, land stewardship, ecology, housing. All of these things are going to be come to the fore at this gathering.
So it's a play and it's an interactive experience for the community to participate in.
Absolutely.
So this April 6th, this weekend, and then the following weekend, April 13th, you'll be in Nipomo doing another reading.
Yes. So that one's at 4 p.m. at the Black Lake Community Center. That's 498 Colonial Place in Nipomo. And that's also free, and that's sponsored by the Nipomo Action Committee, which is one of the activist groups involved with this issue. You can go to their website for more information. That's 4 to 7 next Sunday, April 13th. And again, we'll be looking for community feedback and love for everyone to come.
And then if people want to learn more about Rhizome, are you active with any sort of webpage? You're on the move all the time.
Our webpage, you can go to rhizometheater.org. It's currently under construction, but there's a little bit of information there as well as our email. If you have more specific questions, you can reach out to us via email. Although I will say we really prioritize the live in-person event, so our technological capacities are limited.
Yeah, so if you really want to get to know Kyle and Ashlyn Hatch and the work of Rhizome, then attend this Sunday or the following Sunday. It's called the Nipomo Plot. It's a documentary-style play, staged reading, and community feet talk back.
Absolutely.
Good to see you, Kyle. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us today.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and we are going to slide topics. We're going to stay with this idea of communication and community activism and how we connect with people with different viewpoints with a whole different lens. My guests today are going to be holding a mediation workshop to train others how to do the work of conflict management, improve their family listening skills, improve their own personal and professional lives. So we're going to take a quick break and come back and start this conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Every night that
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And you'll be invited to be part of the conversation coming up. Our number is 805-781-3875. You can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Check out our webpage. We actually have an active website now. You can send me a message through that as well, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. Or you can also find us on Spotify now, which is fabulous. So please go to Spotify, look for the show, listen to a few episodes, leave a review. That'll really help us spread the word on our conversations right here. So my guest right now in the studio, I'm here to talk about a special event in the community. And I'm not sure, I don't think I want to go too deep into the background. I want to kind of jump into it without, so people are kind of a little surprised. But I want to introduce first Stephanie Medina, who is the founder of Flow LLC, lead trainer and facilitator consultant, working for-profit and nonprofits, public organizations, helping them to overcome obstacles, cultivate engaged, inclusive team culture. You teach at Cal Poly and also at the Monterey College of Law and volunteer as a community mediation trainer and consultant. And Stephanie is here with Samantha Watkins, who is also a professional mediator, owner of Solve Consulting and Mediation. You served as the alternative dispute resolution coordinator for the Superior Court of San Luis Obispo. Sounds very lofty. But you also teach at the Monterey College of Law and are the founding board member of Collective Good, which is a center for dispute resolution and training on the Central Coast. So Stephanie, hello.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks so much for having us.
It's nice to meet you. And Sam, hello to you as well.
Hi, Elizabeth.
So coming up on April 16th, 17th, and 18th, the two of you are offering a three-day workshop, The Essentials of Facilitative Mediation. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, but I also hope that we spend a lot of time talking about this idea that mediation isn't just about resolving a dispute between parties, but it's really a way of interacting and improving your mental health and well-being and the quality of your relationships. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. You said that very well. Okay. Yes, that is exactly it.
So I guess, Stephanie, I'll start with you. How did you come to the work of mediation? Why was it important to you?
Oh, gosh. I certainly did not grow up thinking, I want to be a mediator when I grow up. It never occurred to me. I didn't even know what mediation was. So I sort of stumbled into it, to be honest with you. I had graduated and had some student loans I needed to pay, and there weren't a lot of jobs available. And I took a job at the Community Mediation Center, not really knowing what I was getting into. I have a counseling background and education. And I met Sam there. That's where our connection happened. And what I discovered was that as a counselor and educator, I had a lot of tools, but I had been missing some tools. Mm-hmm. When it came to conflict, I really, you know, I would work with students at the time, and they would have really meaningful conflicts from their perspective. You know, things like, you copied my haircut, or you don't sit with me at lunch anymore. And I used the tools that my parents or my teachers had taught me, you know, come to a compromise or say you're sorry, shake hands, Rochambeau maybe, something like that. And I just thought, well, it just takes time. And then when I learned mediation, I thought, wow, there is a real way to actually help folks reconnect, help them to overcome what's between them and be able to move forward, whether that's together as friends or choosing different paths, but being able to move forward instead of being stuck. So that's sort of how I stumbled into mediation, and it has certainly changed my path forever.
How long have you been doing the Flow LLC?
Good question. So I worked with Sam directly for close to a decade, I would say. And then as a mother of my second child, actually, I was wearing too many hats and just needed to make some changes. And so I had a really supportive partner who said, yeah, go for it. Jump out and, you know, do this as a consultant. And it's been really wonderful. I've been able to work with different organizations than I had at the Community Mediation Center, but still getting to be involved in community mediation as a volunteer, too. So it's been great.
And so, Sam, sounds like you're the instigator then of Stephanie's mediation life. How did you come to find yourself doing this work?
I, again, stumbled across it because the word mediation and the concept of a mediator isn't something that a lot of people are used to. And so for me, it was a career change. Prior to becoming a mediator, I think a lot of my mediation training was in my previous job, which was working at a child abuse prevention, intervention, and treatment program with children, especially preschoolers. And what was interesting about that is when you're working with children who have been through some kind of trauma, who have behavioral difficulties, you do a lot of okay, take a breath, use your words, not your hands, trying to help them figure out what really matters, what is their need that they're not really recognizing they have that they're fighting for. And grownups are the same way. They often get into a position where they have a need that's not being met, but they kind of lose touch with what their need is, and they get into a positional stance where they're just fighting for something. And so I really have enjoyed this. It's a change of mindset, really. And I've been doing this since 2006.
For quite a while.
Long time, yeah.
So let's start off with what people don't understand about conflict itself, the nature of conflict. Because most people, if you ask them, you know, most people say, I'm conflict averse. I never want conflict. And that's most people. I'm not confrontational. And they kind of put the two, conflict and confrontation, and then anger and hate, all in the same bubble. So can you, and I don't know who wants to jump in, Samantha, what is conflict as opposed to being about confrontation or anger or hate?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So I think we often sort of start with this idea of, you know, what does conflict look like when we're kids, when we start developing these ideas about what conflict is? And if you imagine, you know, kind of go back in time, you're on the playground, somebody cuts in front of you in line for tetherball, right? Your first instinct is get a teacher, tell them you were there first, and be very, very stubborn about it. There is no way that this person was here before me. Because the way that we conceptualize conflict in our society from a very young age is, if I'm going to get what I want or what's rightfully mine, I better be ready to fight for it and prove not only that I'm telling the truth, but that I deserve it and the other person doesn't. I can't do that without an authority. So we create this concept in our mind that conflict is uncomfortable and it makes me have to fight. And I don't like that. And I also need help to be able to deal with it. I can't
aggressive.
Solve it on my own.
This is the way you're describing it. So the whole idea there has to be aggression involved.
Yeah. And I think we internalize that from a young age. And I think that's something that was a huge shift for me as somebody who was working with students as a counselor to recognize it's not just that it takes time or, gosh, conflict sometimes happens and we just have to move through it or ignore it. It's actually that when conflict happens, there's a lot we can gain from that. We can pause and think about what's actually important to me here. Why do I care so much about this? Is there something, a need, like Sam mentioned, that I'm trying to fill here? And I think as we do that, we realize that conflict is actually, it's an essential part of how we move through this world. Groups have to have conflict, right? That's how we figure things out and get people in the right roles and the right spaces. And so I think a lot of what our work is helpful with is folks often walk away saying, I feel far more prepared to handle conflict when it comes up. I feel empowered, and not in a sense that I have to fight or I feel like I can win now, but more that I just know how to navigate it. I can look at it, set it on the table, and not feel like it's on my shoulders. I can just look at it and work with it as something that's on the table that we all need to figure out how to solve together.
Like normalizing that.
Yeah.
So, Sam, can you talk about normalizing conflict? Because, again, people are so phobic about it. Why is conflict important?
Well, we don't know how to have confrontational conversations anymore. We think, and the way that we approach them is to get our hackles up because that's how we gain confidence, you know?
Or power, maybe?
And power. And so this mindset, thinking like a mediator is what I often call it. That's what our training is all about, is learning how to think through that in that mindset. It approaches things often from a place of abundance and definitely from a place of curiosity. And it gives you – sometimes it's even just the words. You know, people can have the motivation and their heart be in the place where they want to try and approach this more healthily, but they don't have the vocabulary for it sometimes. And so I don't know. I'm thinking about all these things right now, and I'm thinking about what Kyle was talking about earlier and what he does. And so much of it is so similar. I haven't actually watched one of your presentations. I plan to on April 6th. But at the, what we do in mediation, for example, at the very beginning of any mediation, I have two questions. And the first is, how did you get where you are in this situation? And the second is, what are you hoping for from this process? Mm-hmm. And I feel like what Kyle is doing in creating the script and the opportunity to, in a very creative and dramatic way, kind of answer that question, I think, of how did you get where you are in the situation? Like, what is the situation in a living way with the members of the community often? And then not just sitting in that space, but looking forward. What do you want from this process? You know, where do we want to go? And it sounds kind of hippy-dippy when I'm talking about mediation, but so often people come at things from a very contrarian perspective. And when they start to slow down and talk about what matters most, often what matters most is something they value. They have a mm-hmm. shared value, but they have a different perspective of how to get there.
Mm-hmm. And that, so, the parties involved, you say, have a shared value.
Yes.
That's
most of
what
the
they
time.
Find.
Yeah.
And you said there's two questions. Like, one is what brought you here? And the second one is where do you hope to go with it? And from my experience, very few people have any idea where they want to go with things. That yes. seems to be in couples' relationships and in any, you know, situation, that without understanding what it is you're even fighting for or about is where people seem to get most stuck.
Yes.
Why is that?
I think often it's because we're really good at venting about our conflict. It feels really good to call up your best friend and tell them what happened with your partner and have them say, oh, how terrible of them, right? That's what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. And rarely does our best friend say, well, what do you want to do about it now? Mm-hmm. What we actually often experience is our friend fires us up and then we go have another argument, right? The next iteration of the argument. We really don't take the time to think through, what is it that I want? I just want to vent about what already happened.
Well, and it goes back to what you were describing on the playground and mm-hmm. being in line for tetherball. Even when people come to me as a mediator and they come to me with their issue, they've read my website, mm-hmm. but they still come to me and think I'm going to fix the problem.
Yes.
And the name of my business is SOLVE, Consulting and Mediation, but it's an acronym. Mm-hmm. And the SOLVE stands for Summarize, Observe, Listen, Validate, and Empower.
I like that.
And when
Say
you're
it
venting,
again.
When you're venting, you're often looking for that validation. So SOLVE for me stands for Summarize, Observe, Listen, Validate, and Empower, which mm-hmm. is what I do as a mediator. Mm-hmm. Because it's not up to me to look at the evidence, read the briefings, hear the stories, take it all in, and then suddenly like a machine spit out the answer.
Exactly.
Because I only ever know, you can't see me because we're on the radio, but I hold up my fingers and I show like an inch, and I remind myself that no matter how long I've been working with these people who are in this situation, I only ever know that inch, this much, right? Mm-hmm. And so the people who are in conflict are the experts in what their needs are, mm-hmm. but they're stuck. So they just need some tools. It's kind of like imagining a ball of yarn with a lot of knots on it in the middle of the table. I bring all kinds of great crochet hooks and neat tools to help pull it apart. They have some of their own tools, but they've forgotten how to use them or never taught. Mm-hmm. And we work together to kind of figure it out. And sometimes figuring it out means the people who are in conflict agree that they'll never agree, mm-hmm. that they honestly, regardless of their life situation, maybe don't like spending time together and they don't want to continue to do so. And so they move on in different directions, but at least they're going forward and they're not stuck anymore.
Yeah, you brought up two thoughts in my head. One is this idea we're taught from an early age that we should get along with everyone.
Yeah.
Because from the time you're in elementary school, it's everyone's your friend. And that really isn't a truth. And wouldn't we be better off telling children from a young age, hey, you're going to have, you know, those that you love, those that you tolerate, and those that you just give a birth to, but, you know, wide birth to, or you give birth to and you never speak to again. There could be that as well. I wish in some ways, kind of veering off, that we talked honestly about
yeah.
the nature of human relationships, because we put so much pressure on people to feel like they have to get along mm-hmm. that I think they fumble. And then the other idea of knowing what it is we want from it, I think we also don't help people understand that they can want things
yes.
and to be able to define them. And I think that's where a lot of anger comes from, because it's a frustration of not getting what we want, but also not feeling allowed to express what it is we want. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guests today are here talking about a workshop that's coming up, Essentials of Facilitative Mediation, that's going to be happening in Avila Beach, April 16th, 17th, and 18th. It's open to the public. It's a training for teachers and professionals and family members, parents, anyone who would like to be able to learn to navigate and learn new tools for managing change and conflict and transitions. So Samantha and Sam are here from their respective positions of mediators. We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue the conversation. We'll also open up the phone lines if you have any questions for my guests. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Sometimes I'm tired and I wonder what's so all fired important about being someplace at some time. Whoa, but I don't really mind. I could be on Easy Street, and I know that you got to take the bitter with the sweet. I guess it gets to everyone. You think you're not having any fun, and you wonder what you're doing, playing the games you play. Hey, well, it's true what they say. If you want to feel complete, don't you know that the sweet. A friend of mine once told me, and I know he knows all about feeling down. He said, everything good in life you got to pay for, but feeling good isn't what you're paving the way for. La, 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 la.
Don't you like today's music?
I'm loving it.
I know. I had fun going through kind of these like deep tracks of Carole King, and it's like some beautiful, those little Stevie Nicks earlier, Storms.
You're on a bit of a roll this afternoon with your music choices, for
Thank
sure.
You. I appreciate that, because music is such a big piece of the show, trying to kind of tie all these things together. My guests today are Samantha Watkins, Sam, and Stephanie
Medina.
Thank
yes,
you.
Got you.
I just turned my page. I can't go back. Stephanie Medina and Sam Watkins. They're both professional mediators, and they're here talking about what mediation looks like and what conflict actually looks like, and also to talk about this Essentials of Facilitative Mediation workshop that's going to be happening the 16th, 17th, and 18th of April. So it's three long days with lots of great skill sets. And Sam, could you talk about how, if people are interested, they get involved?
Probably the easiest way to get more information is to go to my website, which is, as we mentioned, SOLVE, the acronym, solvecm.com. So solve consulting and mediation.com. And when you go to that page, you'll see my picture. And right next to my picture, it says learn more. And you can click on that, and it'll give you all the information you need.
And so, Stephanie, who should come to this three-day workshop?
Gosh, one of the beauties of this workshop is it is such a widespread, background, I would say. So many people from so many different professions, interests come to this training. And because of that, the conversations are really rich. In fact, Sam and I say we learn something new, at least one thing new, every time we hold this training, because of the folks who are in the room, you know, who are really contributing what they know. So we have had, you know, there's always some folks from Cal Poly. We often have folks from the city or public departments, but we also have, you know, private business. We have folks from agriculture. We have folks coming in from different sectors of education. So the skill set that you will walk away with, HR, I should mention, that's another big one. The skill set you will walk away with can be applied at work, absolutely, no matter what your background is. But I think what Sam and I would both attest to is that it kind of becomes a way of moving through the world as well. And so you'll use it in your personal life too.
We have a lot of local businesses or governmental offices that will, someone on a team somewhere will take our training. And before you know it, that government agency or that business is paying for all of their staff to regularly try. And they try to get to the point where everyone in their office has taken it, because it changes the language and how you approach mm-hmm. things. And so we definitely have repeat visitors, and it is something you can ask your boss to pay for.
That's what I was going to say. Are there continuing education units involved with it, or?
Not currently. So okay. Not necessarily on the MFT or therapist realm. although that is something that is a possibility.
We just haven't gone there yet.
And then we also could do the same in the legal world. It kind of – it's interesting. Mediation sort of has a foot in either world. It sort of straddles those two worlds.
And so it's $800, $799 for the 3 days. And what are those essential skills that people are going to come away with? What should they expect to gain?
If I could summarize it, and I'm sure Sam will add on to this, but if I could summarize it, I would say folks will probably walk away seeing conflict differently and feeling empowered to navigate it, because they'll understand what it means to not get attached to an outcome and instead to bring some curiosity. They'll have questions, specific questions they can use to engage parties in talking through something. They'll be able to look at themselves and look at their own biases maybe, or assumptions they're making when they're going into conflict. They'll understand what it means to be positional versus focusing on what are the underlying interests that we really need to resolve and address here. So you'll walk away with an understanding of those dynamics, the psychology of conflict, and feel ready to be able to help someone else solve conflict, but also ready to better reflect on what's going on inside you when you're in a conflict and how can you approach that conflict more productively.
Yeah, and based on that learning, there's also some negotiation strategies that you pick up on that oftentimes are very similar to that author, the hostage negotiator, Chris Voss. He talks about a lot of these things. He comes at it from a very strategic place, and we come at it from a more psychological place, but it's the same idea. It's, for example, one of the things that we talk about is setting boundaries. You hear it all the time nowadays. Mm-hmm. I'm going to set a boundary so that I can feel safe. And, you know, the Chamber of Commerce asked me to come in right before Thanksgiving and do a talk that might help people who are listening to deal with some of the political tension that they might experience at the table for Thanksgiving. And they said, yeah, can you come in and just teach people about conflict resolution? We'll give you 5 minutes.
Because all things are done in 5 minutes.
No problem. So I had to really ponder and think about something I could give people in just 5 minutes. And it's something we've talked about before that I actually would love to write a book on someday. And it's a concept of setting boundaries. And what I ask people is, if you're going to set a boundary, right, to protect yourself, think of it this way. If you're going to build a fence to protect your backyard, mm-hmm. should you build your fence on your neighbor's property?
Probably not.
Probably not. If you did build your fence on your neighbor's property, how might they react? Mm-hmm. They might be angry. They might be defensive. And they would be appropriately responding. And so when you're setting a boundary, you have to recognize that you have to set that boundary, that fence, on your own property, which means your boundary is about yourself. You can make a request of someone else. You and the other person can agree on a rule that you want to follow. But if you want to protect yourself and to have control over your circumstances, that's all about what you do. You can never control someone else's behavior. So to say, don't talk to me like that, or I won't let you talk to me like that, that's not quite a boundary. You're actually wanting them to control their behavior. To say, if you speak to me like that, I may get up and leave. That's a boundary. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. In the work environment, don't send me emails on the weekends. That's not a boundary. That's trying to control someone else's behavior. I don't respond to weekends on the weekend emails. I'll respond on Monday is a boundary. So these kinds of simple just reframing of your thought process gives you a lot more power when you're feeling stuck and you're needing – you know you need to respond and you can feel your body reacting. These tools give you a chance to take a breath and respond instead of react.
I want to add to that too.
We're going now.
Here's the Sam and Steph special. So as Sam talks about boundaries, you know, I mentioned earlier, we talked about this a lot, that often we go into conflict positional. And often our positions come out sounding like those fence in the neighbor's yard kinds of boundaries. And what allows us to set a boundary that's in our own yard, that's about our own behavior and our own space, is being able to pause and think, what's actually under my position right now? What is my underlying interest? And
basically,
that's what I
want
to protect.
Why do I want to bail when things get challenging?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why do I want to do that? And why do I feel a need for a boundary here? And if I operate from that place, I'm less likely to be defensive or attached to a particular outcome. Instead, I feel calm and secure in what it is that I need to protect for myself, but also open to the idea that the other person probably has some things that they're trying to protect for themselves too. Mm-hmm. And we can sort this out together. Thank you.
So as I take a breath.
Sorry, we talk really
fast. No, that's totally fine because I I have a thing about boundaries. And so my first reaction is, oh, I'm feeling a little pushback, because my experience with boundaries is that people quite often use them to avoid having to deal with any issues. Mm-hmm. And so when you say so nicely, well, think about what it is, if you speak to me this way, then I'm going to choose to get up and leave. That's how people never resolve anything. So I don't know if that's a great boundary marker, to be honest.
I'm so glad you said that, because one of the way that we take this concept is that you don't want to set yourself up to be in a place where you can't address things that you need to address. So for example, if you have, if anybody out there has little kids and you've ever taken your 2-year-old to the grocery store, if you say to your child before you go in, or maybe they're a little older and you say, if you throw a tantrum, if you have a big fit, we're going to leave. Mm-hmm. And that you've set that up, and then you go inside, you shop for at least a half an hour or more, your cart is full, and then they throw a tantrum. Now what do you have to do? You have to leave. And so when you're setting a boundary for yourself, don't you set yourself up for failure. Mm-hmm. Don't say, if you do this, then I'm going to this. That's a threat, not a boundary.
Right.
And the
I guess I'm trying to understand how your example is different than a threat.
Mm-hmm. Well, an example would be, well, give me a situation where someone is doing something that is annoying you or bothering you or causing you difficulty.
Your dog barks all the time. And I've had it. So I'm just going to call you. Every single time that your dog barks, I'm going to call you. And I expect you to answer that phone. That's what's going
to
happen.
Well, see, now, if that were to occur, I would call my local community mediation center and get free services.
To find out if they actually can do that?
Yes. But that sounds like I'm going to get a lot of annoying phone calls.
And I'm going to text you at all hours because I need you to fix this.
Yeah. So the first thing that we talk about, one of the things that we talk about, is spheres of influence, which is you can imagine a small circle, and that's all the things that you have power and control over. Just outside that circle, things that you can influence, and then that edge circle that we're always trying to have impact on is things you can't control. Mm-hmm. And what always lives outside in that circle are other people's behavior. So in that circumstance, I'm going to check on my own boundaries and the curiosity for myself about what's important to me. And I'm going to look at what I can control and what I can influence, and then I'm going to have to recognize what I have no control over. So a boundary in that circumstance is going to take me a minute, because you're saying mean things about my dog and I'm going to react emotionally and get defensive.
Right.
When I'm finally able to calm down and use some of my skills, I might use a technique that we use in mediation. It's called the dog tilt, where when you're feeling tight and you're feeling angry, if you slow yourself down and take a deep breath and actually tilt your head like a puppy, it sometimes tells your internal self to be curious. And so I'll use the dog tilt to be curious about where you're coming from and what's bothering me, where you're getting at with me, and then figure out where I can set a boundary or fence or something to make sure that I don't feel unsafe, so that we can communicate about this in a way that's productive. And where I would feel unsafe is if you're yelling at me, if you're threatening my dog, and then I'd have to think about, you know, where can I make sure that we can have this conversation in a way that makes sense and I'm not going to react to those things. I'll also recognize, as angry as I am, I can turn off my phone. That is something I can do. Mm-hmm. And that's a boundary that I can set. Now, it kind of goes to your situation of maybe being avoidant because I'm not necessarily addressing it. But if it's the middle of the night, that's how I'm going to address it, is by not having my phone on so that you can't get – or I can block you or something like that. That doesn't mean that I've dealt with the conflict. I've avoided it. So boundaries aren't necessarily there to – you know, nowadays so many people are cutting off from others that they just don't want to deal with. They call them toxic, those kinds of things. There are safety issues where that might be necessary. But if you're still living with the angst, then that means you haven't actually dealt with it. I actually love conflict. I know that sounds weird because some people call me a peacemaker, a peacekeeper. I don't necessarily do that. I see conflict as opportunities for growth, opportunities for learning. And so often when we just set a boundary and we don't address the issue, then we're not learning the lesson that the universe has brought to us, to our doorstep. And if we don't learn the lesson in that environment, the universe will. They're very consistent. They'll follow up with another lesson that might be harder to get past.
At some point it goes there. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guests today are Stephanie Medina and Sam Watkins. They are the co-facilitators of Essentials of Facilitative Mediation. That's going to be in April 16th, 17th, and 18th, where you'll come away with the skills to hopefully be able to move forward with some challenging issues in your life. So let's talk about the idea of, you brought up bias awareness and neutrality. Why is that important in conflict work?
Oh, gosh, it's important in so much of what we've been talking about. I'm going to use an example actually that just happened. And of course, listeners can't see us, you know, engaging in the studio. But, you know, you just brought up, Elizabeth, oh, gosh, when you say boundaries, I have a feeling, and you kind of put your finger towards your chest, like, I feel it here. And I think that is a really good example of bias awareness. Mm-hmm. For many of us, we kind of grew up feeling like, if I have a feeling, that means something, and I just act on it immediately. And the work of bias awareness is actually about checking in and saying, where does that feeling come from? And that's exactly what you did. So in the work of conflict, to be able to address something that doesn't feel good right away, we have to bring curiosity, which Sam mentioned, and ask ourselves first, what is going on in me? Sam and I both do a lot of consulting work, and businesses will call. I think for a while there, it was kind of like, you'll get a discount on your insurance if you do some, you know, mm-hmm. anti-bias training, right? So we would get these calls, and we both said, gosh, it's actually impossible to get rid of biases. We can't do bias elimination. You know, right. we can do bias awareness. And really what that is recognizing, if I'm doing a whole bunch of interviews and I decide I'm going to take this candidate out because something just didn't feel right in me, I might be losing a really great candidate. But if I have become aware of my biases, I can say, something didn't feel right. What was that? And if I sit with it for a minute, I might go, oh, reminds me of that person that bullied me in middle school. Mm-hmm. And is this that person? Probably not. Maybe I can bring curiosity to this. And it's really kind of impossible to move through conflict without being able to learn something new about the situation. And if we're really tight in our perspective on things and we're not able to look at our own biases or assumptions, it makes it really difficult to find out the new stuff, which is where the answers, the resolutions usually live.
Mm-hmm. The new ways of interacting with people.
And being aware of your biases isn't just being aware of negative biases. We also have very positive biases sometimes. Okay. But it's something that when you don't know about it, you don't have power control over it. It just moves you in certain directions. And so one of the homework assignments that I always give students in our classes is the next time you're standing in line at the coffee shop or the grocery store and you're having to wait, instead of pulling out your phone, just take a breath and look around you and ask yourself if there's anybody nearby you that causes you to feel a positive feeling or a negative feeling. And then go deeper. What is it about that person that's causing you to feel positive or negative? This was an exercise I did early in 2006 when I was learning about mediation. And I found out it was a negative bias. Well, it was kind of both, actually. But I found out I had feelings, very strong feelings, when there was someone around me who smelled like cigarette smoke. Because the olfactory senses are sometimes the strongest ones. Mm-hmm. And I realized after thinking and pondering that it was because both of my parents were smokers and they both died early deaths of cancer. And so I have these anxious feelings that I didn't even know I had until I took that moment to realize. And it's funny because it makes me feel a little bit at home, but it also makes me feel anxious. Mm-hmm. But I do have this almost visceral reaction that I wasn't aware I was having when I was smelling that smell. Mm-hmm. And so that activity is a part of your, quote, bias awareness training. It's just being aware of what your body's telling you. We ignore our bodies all the time. Mm-hmm. And so tuning into that and allowing it to make you ponder things that you could learn about yourself and how you might be reacting to something. It's very helpful.
And so that seems like it'd be a good thing to do just for a person in general as we move through our day-to-day, because we talk about how there's so much tension in society in all aspects, politically and socially and economically, to be able to first have that self-awareness, which again kind of goes back to what I brought up at the beginning of the hour, is the idea that most people that I've experienced who struggle because they don't know what it is they want at the end of the conflict. And so I'd like to focus a bit on that, you know, again, the bias awareness. But how can people start to allow themselves to desire an outcome, and two, to recognize that in order to have relationships, you have to have some sort of goal or desired outcome mm-hmm. for the relationship to succeed? Stephanie.
If it's okay, I want to share with you a very short version of a famous story in the world of mediation, and that's the story of the orange and the sisters. So I'm going to make it very short, but essentially two teenage sisters are fighting over this orange, right? And they're shouting at each other. They called it first, or I grabbed it first, or I had it. Their mom gets involved, and mom says, "What's going on? I can't believe your teenager's fighting over an orange. Can't you learn how to solve things?" And, you know, at the end of the argument, they just continue on with mom. You know, she's your favorite. You always take her side. Can't you pick my side this time? All of this, what we would call positional discussion, right? Which sounds very familiar to many of us that are parents, of course, but also just in general in life. And so mom ultimately takes this orange, and she's a good mom. I would have taken it and said, nobody gets it. But she's a better mother than I am. And she cuts it perfectly in half and gives them each half of the orange. Well, one sister takes her half and juices it. The other sister takes her half and uses the zest of the orange, each of them throwing away what the other could have used. And so, of course, the point of this story is to recognize that there was an opportunity missed there, mm-hmm. right? But if we think about this story for a second, a few things are going on. Number one, folks will say, well, they didn't communicate. Well, they did actually communicate a lot. There was a lot of communication happening. But it was really ineffective communication because what they weren't talking about is what you mentioned. What do they want? Mm-hmm. And the story for, you know, the sister who used the zest is she was making these cupcakes that required zest, and the cupcakes were going to be used to support a club at a bake sale. And there was really, if we get really Maslow about it, it was about belonging, wanting to really make a good impact on this club. And the other sister was getting the juice for this fresh squeezed juice drink that her coach had encouraged her to get to stay healthy and do well in this track meet, et cetera, et cetera. So there was this need for accomplishment and to follow the coach's instructions. And then the other thing that's happening is they're not talking about any of that, right? They're also turning to mom to solve this.
Right,
and mom does her best. She's the authority, right? And the authority, just like any parent, probably had limited time and needed to solve it quickly. And so we often say, well, was mom's solution fair? And if we stop and think about it, it was, mm-hmm. right? It was 50-50. But it didn't solve the problem. And it didn't solve it because what they actually needed, what they wanted, was not discussed. So they also didn't have a solution that was based on what was discussed. Mm-hmm. So for them to find a solution that actually would have been about what they want, and for them to really acknowledge what deep down was important to them and try to go after that, they would have needed a little bit of help as teenagers mm-hmm. with some questions from this neutral authority figure or a neutral person about, well, tell me more about that. What is it about the orange? And tell me how you got here, but also what would you like to have happen? And as soon as we shift from what happened, why are you fighting over the orange, which creates that defensive positional language, and we go into that future-oriented talk about what is it that you want here? I agree with you. Many times people are stumped. Mm-hmm. And yet if we give them the space to talk about it, they suddenly realize there is something that's important to them. And it's okay to, instead of building a case against the other person or trying to prove that their story is the truth, it's actually okay and more helpful to just come out and be a little vulnerable and say what it is that's important to you and what you want.
And it's interesting because in the therapeutic world, that's the hardest part of any relationship, is that being vulnerable, mm-hmm. that I'd rather die on my sword fighting with you than to admit that I do have deep desires, mm-hmm. because then I run the risk of you saying those desires are not valid.
Yep. Yes. The first step in any mediation process is building trust. Mm-hmm. And in mediation, it's often building trust in the process, because you may not be able to build trust with the other party, who in the current situation might be a monster in your eyes. Mm-hmm. But building trust in the process that it might get you somewhere. And so it's just – trust is an essential piece of everything that we talk about. Mm-hmm. Because being able to be vulnerable requires trust.
Right. Mm-hmm. But then how do you build that trust with someone that at the end of your mm-hmm. Mediation are no longer going to be friends? Because you said at the beginning that's part of mediation, is that you might decide, you know what, there really is nothing here. We just have to coexist. So what is the trust that you're building?
Well, mm-hmm. for an environment like that where the situation might lead in that direction, it's not necessarily about building friendship, building relationship. Mm-hmm. It's about building trust in the process of mediation, mm-hmm. trusting the mediator to help you in the ways that are appropriate, to help empower you to figure things out, trusting yourself because you're finally in this moment able to get to what you really need, and it feels good. And trusting the outcome, because it wasn't that the mediator took in all the information and then made a decision that you have to live with.
Right.
You're the person who's in charge of the outcome.
Right.
And so that way, therefore, because of that process, you can trust that you've made a decision that you've had time to think about, that you've had some tools to process through, that you have decided for yourself so that you can move forward.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, Elizabeth, you know, that these skills can apply to family, they can apply to workplace. And so I just want to point out with this trust piece that often the trust is also kind of in our shared values, whatever we have said those are. So in the workplace, it might be, you know, we're inclusive and customer service is a priority, et cetera. And so if we're going to have a difficult conversation in the workplace, we're often going to ground the conversation in those values or whatever the mission is. In a family, we often haven't ever said our values out loud. And so frequently what we're doing, and probably what's happening in, you know, in couples therapy, is coming to a place where we do identify what are those shared values that we can trust. Because sometimes when we can't trust each other, mm-hmm. if we know we're agreeing, we're gonna base whatever our conclusion is on these values, that gives us one little shred of trust to start with.
Mm-hmm. In working with people who work together in a team environment, not everyone's going to have the same personality style, and sometimes they're going to rub each other the wrong way. And one of the things in the one-on-one coachings that I do is helping them get to a point where they can recognize that this other person that in their personal life they would never necessarily want to hang around with, that they can believe that that other person cares deeply about their work, that they can respect their work ethic, and they can trust that this person wants what's best for the company or what's best for the work environment or what's best for their clients. Usually they're working for other clients. Often in a nonprofit world, they believe that this person, who they might not necessarily like very much, they can trust that this person believes in the mission. Mm-hmm. And that's enough mm-hmm. sometimes.
To have that common view.
Yes.
I think of something my dad said to me, which was so incredibly helpful with the whole road rage driving intensity that we experience all over with people driving too fast or too slow. And he just very simply said to me, you know, you have to look at the cars around you and remember they have just as much right to be on the road as you do. And that changed everything about the way I drove immediately. The That's hour awesome. Goes so quickly, so I just want to remind people that if they would like to spend 3 days learning these essential skills of facilitative mediation, how do they get the information?
The Sam? Website is solvecm.com, and you'll see right on the front page there's a place where you can click on something that says learn more, and it'll take you to the place to learn more about this training and also eventually take you to the registration page.
April 16th, 17th, 18th, I imagine, Stephanie, that people make new friendships out of this because you have like-minded people curious about this work. So in that way, it'd be a positive experience.
Absolutely. We actually have a group that sort of has evolved out of this training that's a leadership, facilitative leadership working group. And so folks often stay in touch and stay involved in that, and it's been really helpful for folks.
And then becomes a foundation. Maybe they want to take on the mediation skill training as well after this to add it to their quiver.
Yep.
Thank you both so much for being a part of the conversation. This has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can find me on Spotify, on Facebook, on Instagram, all those great social media platforms, or send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. As always, I appreciate you tuning in and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Regrets collect like old friends, here to relive your darkest moments. I can see no way, I can see no way. And all of the ghouls come out to play, and every demon wants his pound of flesh. But I like to keep some things to myself. I like to keep my shoes drawn. It's always darkest before the